Well, that's the first time I heard a blues treatment of that Johnny Cash tune. That is fabulous. Not too much fabulous around these days, it seems. Going back into protocols on your own or not, the positivity rate, I didn't check, but the numbers that I get for cases are quite high. I'm consumed with writing an article about what I bring up every now and again, the Bayh-Dole bill that allowed the exploitation of scientific research by private companies, and the walk-in rights. It's a very loaded term, so I'm trying to write on it. Nobody else seems to be talking about it. But that's part of the thesis also, is the media, while being extremely lousy on economics reporting, is even more abysmal on big pharma. All right. Well, I've got a packed show, and not surprisingly, it's about Afghanistan. I've got two women. Phyllis Bennis was interviewed on Tuesday morning. There are a few things that might be resolvable in the meantime. There's a show called Upfront, a very good interviewer that I like, Brian Tiekert out of KPFA. And then out of South California, Sonali Kalantar, who was very early with Afghan Women's Mission, now works with Afghan's Women's Fund. She has a colleague on. I'm a little skeptical of some of the assertions. I haven't heard it all, so maybe things get refined. But it's well worth hearing an Afghan woman who's been on the ground doing humanitarian aid for decades now. It's helping widows start businesses. She might be why there are so many women-owned businesses in Afghan, partially, which is something the new regime is going to have to deal with. Will they just take them over? I don't know. They probably don't know how to run them. All right, so maybe there'll be more on that. Like I said, I haven't heard all of it. Mumia has a very short but very poignant commentary, Tears of Empire. Amy Goodman, who had some great stuff this week, and very timely interview with is it Stuart Ackerman? Attackerman on Twitter, has a new full-length book. I should have the title in front of me, but I don't. You can find that Democracy Now. That was just yesterday, including reprising that thing that you heard maybe a little at the time, was that there was an overture from the Taliban about negotiating something to do with Osama bin Laden. But whether it was a serious proposal or not, it was not tested, and it looked like the Bush 2 administration certainly didn't want to test it. Okay, let's see, put this to bed. And Amy Goodman, no. Prisoner Radio, you can find commentary from Mumi Abu-Jamal. Labor Radio Free Labor coming up in an hour. I hosted and had a really intense experience, and I commend it to your attention. Don't listen to satire. Satire doesn't work for me right now. I'm talking about the opposite show on Sibling Radio. Snarky humor is not something I'm not fond of, but the limits of allowable debate on NPR are such that some things that would be really black humorly funny are never treated. All right, here's Mumi Abu-Jamal in good voice and apparently good health after surgery and working on his court case and probably another book as well.
The Tears of Empire. With the dramatic fall of Kabul to the forces of the Taliban, the alligator tears of the political class are falling, decrying the costs weeks of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. What has been thoroughly forgotten, however, is the unprecedented mass protests of February 2003, before the war began, when the earth shook with anti-war fervor in countries across the globe. Then President George W. Bush would ignore these protests as a mere focus group. His words, focus group. In the 2004 book, The Citizens of the Empire, author and critic Robert Jensen recounted the worldwide actions on February 15, 2003 were the single largest political demonstration in history. Millions of people all over the globe poured into the streets to try to derail the Bush administration's mad rush to war. How, in an alleged democracy, can the government so easily ignore the views of millions? It happened, and chaos came to Afghanistan and wreaked havoc for over 20 years. What if the protests had won? We will never know. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
After decades of war, Afghans deserve peace. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. After two decades of U.S. war, occupation, and bloodshed in Afghanistan, the Biden administration has been faulted for not predicting the speed with which the Afghan government, propped up by the American military and trillions of U.S. taxpayer dollars, would collapse.
The enmity with parties to the conflict are over.
That's Taliban spokesperson Zabihullah Mujahid speaking in a news conference from Kabul on Tuesday.
An inclusive government should be formed, and all parties and Afghans should participate in it.
Mujahid was speaking from the office last held by Dawa Khan Manipal, who was assassinated by the Taliban 10 days earlier during Friday prayers. Manipal was a chief spokesperson for President Ghani's government. Responding on the Democracy Now! News Hour, Kabul-based Afghan journalist Bilal Sarwawi said,
"And the Afghan people would like to know, you know, where this road now leads, because people are thirsty for a political settlement. People are thirsty for peace."
Bilal was a refugee from the Afghan civil war of the 1990s, which in turn followed the bloody war with the Soviet Union. He learned English in Peshawar, Pakistan, and returned in 2001 as a TV news crew's fixer as the U.S. invasion began following the 9/11 attacks. Through 20 years of war and occupation, he grew into a seasoned frontline journalist. In a recent piece published in The Telegraph, Bilal described the impact covering violence has had. He said, "It has broken me from within. The number of coffins going back to small villages and valleys, that has been the worst feeling, like 1,000 sharp knives stabbing your heart," he said. Members of Congress have promised investigations into the flawed U.S. retreat. They should look at not just the past 2 weeks or 2 months, but at the whole two decades of this disastrous war and occupation. The Watson Institute estimates over 47,000 Afghan civilians were killed and over 75,000 injured during the war. The U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction calls these numbers both likely significant underestimations. Close to 70,000 Afghan soldiers and police have been killed, 50,000 Taliban and other opposition fighters, over 2,400 U.S. service members, and close to 4,000 U.S. contractors, including journalists, aid workers, and NATO soldiers killed, totaling at least 170,000 people killed overall. Amidst the chaos of the frantic U.S. withdrawal this week, several people clung to the outside of large U.S. military planes during takeoff, eventually plummeting to their deaths or dying in transit in an airplane wheel well. U.S. soldiers are reportedly conferring with Taliban forces to maintain order at the Kabul airport, and both groups have killed a number of civilians desperately vying for a flight out of the country. Matthew Ho was the first U.S. State Department official known to resign in protest over the Afghan war in 2009. He described the failed U.S. strategy in Afghanistan on Democracy Now!
bombing villages and doing night raids, and sending commandos 20 times a night into Afghan villages to kick in doors and kill people. And you saw the results of that. The results of that was every year the Taliban got stronger. Every year the Taliban gained more support.
Ho is not optimistic, adding,
I think the only thing more tragic than what's happened to the Afghan people is that in a few days, America will have forgotten Afghanistan again.
Afghans won't forget the U.S., though. Zahra Nader is a graduate student in Toronto, Canada. Born in Bamiyan, Afghanistan, she fled to Iran with her family, where she grew up as a refugee, unable to attend school. They returned to Afghanistan in 2004, and after only a few years of schooling, became a reporter, eventually writing for the New York Times. Zahra left that dream job to move to Canada to ensure her young son had more opportunity than she had as a child. In a phone conversation, Zahra offered a damning summary of the U.S. role in Afghanistan, starting with the late 1970s. She said,
The U.S. Supported Afghan Mujahideen, the Islamist fundamentalist group in Afghanistan, to fight a proxy war with the Soviets. So this happening with the direct U.S. support, the rise of the fundamentalists in Afghanistan. Till 2001, the situation of women's rights, the situation of human rights, did not matter to anybody in the U.S. or other Western countries. When the situation of Afghan women became a deal, when it became a big deal, in 2001, when the 9/11 happened. Before then, it seems that we did not exist. They used us to frame their war.
For Zahra Nader, for Bilal Sarwari, and tens of millions of Afghans, the difficult task of rebuilding is beginning anew. The United States has a responsibility to support these efforts without trying to control them. The U.S. should also learn finally, as the most recent empire to flee Afghanistan, that you can't bomb your way to peace. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, and did not include Spencer Ackerman. The book is called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. And he had a great interview, yesterday's Democracy Now! Check that out. He's been doing them thick and fast. There's one on Sirius, which I should be able to get. Looking for some more material from him, maybe for tomorrow. Okay, but right now, let's go on with what I storyboarded, and let's see about segment from Upfront. This is from Tuesday, so things moved fast, but since the whole premise was what will happen next in the longer term, I think it's well worth hearing. I mentioned there's one anomaly that then shows up in the next incongruity. What Ashraf Ghani did, he eventually went to UAE, probably with the U.S. Facilitating it. But apparently he tried a couple of other countries closer to Afghanistan, and they turned him back. So I don't know if the U.S. would have facilitated such a thing, but then considering how the extractions are going generally, maybe they did not know that they had to talk to the countries that they were trying to get their leader into. The second interview includes a woman who says that Ashraf Ghani was not corrupt, was a well-meaning guy, which was a surprise to me, but I don't know. She's Afghani and works with this Afghan Women's Fund, which I think grew out of Afghan Women's Mission that Sonali Kalhatar, the interviewer, had something to do with starting. So if we're going to get this on, let's begin it now.
War in U.S. history is over. The only part of Afghanistan currently controlled by the United States or its allies is the international airport, in which we are running a mass evacuation. President Biden now saying U.S. troops will stay to evacuate U.S. citizens and Afghan allies, warning there would be a devastating response to any disruption. The Taliban forces that have taken over Kabul and the rest of the country apparently okay with that. so far sounding conciliatory notes. We thought this would be a good time to talk about what comes next after the longest war in U.S. history. We're joined by Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her books include Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer. Phyllis, thanks for coming back on.
Great to be with you, Brian.
First of all, I wanted to kind of ground the conversation in what's going to happen in Afghanistan. I know it's hard to generalize, but how is the Taliban that's taking control of the country now different from the Taliban that kicked out Russian-backed forces in the 90s?
You know, I think that's exactly the right question we should be asking. The problem is I don't think we know enough to say exactly what's different about the Taliban individuals who make up the organization, what's different about the organization's functioning. What we do know is that the world in which they are taking power this time is a very different world than it was 20 years ago. Afghanistan is not nearly as isolated as it was back then. The rise, if we look just at the question of cell phones and the internet, has transformed the world so that even though 75% of Afghans still live in very isolated villages, it's significant that the access to at least cell phones, if not the internet, is common now. I was struck by the photographs and the video of the Taliban, including many young Taliban officers or soldiers who had taken over the U.S. ambassador's office in the embassy. Not the ambassador's office. It was the presidency in Kabul, not the U.S. embassy. It was the presidency center in Kabul. And every one of them, they were quite happy. They weren't destroying things. They were sitting there looking around as if they were not quite sure what to do. Every one of them was holding up a cell phone. They were taking selfies. You know, this is a different world. We don't know exactly what that's going to mean. I think it's certainly possible that it may mean that whatever changes have or have not gone on in the ideology of the Taliban, it may be just as extreme as it ever was, and there may in fact be some members who are even more extreme than 20 years ago. But I think that it's certainly likely that at least some of the leadership have recognized that they are going to be quite dependent on outside support for quite some time. They're going to need economic aid. They're going to need technological assistance to help with dealing with running cities, which the Taliban has never done. They've always had their areas of control in the countryside, in rural areas, where they didn't have to worry about organizing complex cities like Kabul, a city of 6 million people. So they're going to need that kind of assistance. And they may be recognizing that the world is going to make requirements of them. And those requirements may well include different kind of treatment. I don't think it's going to be a great thing for Afghan women. I don't think it means that the world is going to say, well, sorry, now that you're in control, we need you to treat women as equals. That's not realistic. Most countries in the world don't treat their women as equals anyway. But it may mean that some of the most extreme kinds of repression, beatings in the street for being insufficiently covered, that sort of thing, denying women the right to school. Those things may change. They may recognize that if they want to get that kind of support from and relations with the rest of the world, they're going to have to make some of those changes that they haven't had to make in the past.
Well, what do we know about how other countries are positioning themselves to have relations with the Afghan government under the Taliban?
It's very early yet to say. What we know is that China has made clear they had a high-level diplomatic meeting with the Chinese foreign minister in China about 3 weeks ago now. Russia has said explicitly they are keeping their embassy open. Their embassy is still open, as is the embassy of China. They have not closed their embassies. The Europeans are meeting today. The European Union and European NATO countries are meeting today to decide how to deal with the question of recognition and representation. I think that they're dealing with the reality that it's always better to have contact with governments, even when you disagree. And that diplomatic recognition does not mean diplomatic support. It means that you acknowledge reality. You acknowledge what government is in control. The U.S. has made a terrible legacy all around the world of refusing to talk to governments it decides it doesn't like. And as we know, that doesn't do anybody any good on any side. So I think for the Europeans, they haven't quite figured out yet whether they're going to maintain some level of recognition and representation. But I think we can anticipate that the new government, which we also don't know yet whether it's going to be the Taliban alone or whether they're going to try to cobble together some kind of a coalition or what a pseudo coalition. There's no question the Taliban will be the dominant force within it, but it may or may not be the only force. Whatever that government is, as it emerges, it's likely to take Afghanistan's seat at the United Nations, for instance. That means that whether or not the U.S. opens an embassy in Kabul and allows a Taliban-controlled embassy to open in Washington, there will be that kind of representation in New York at UN headquarters. So these are the kinds of things that I think are just being sorted out. But I think that the role of both global powers, particularly Russia and China, regional powers, including Iran, as well as the neighbors of Afghanistan, whether that be Pakistan, the other stands, as it were, are going to be very concerned about stability. You know, none of them want instability on their borders. None of them want to face huge refugee flows. So there's going to be a lot of concern about what is it going to take to keep things calm in Afghanistan.
Who would the Taliban form a coalition with? Who do they need to share power with if they're doing any kind of power sharing? The government the U.S. stood up just kind of melted away.
It did at the national level. I think there are still officials in municipalities, in the cities and towns, in the regions. From what we're hearing today, it seems that the Taliban has installed its own governors in each region, in each province. But I haven't heard yet whether there are still people at work, whether it's the deputy governor, perhaps, or heads of city councils, that sort of thing. So it may be people like that. It may be technical, trained people in Kabul or in Kandahar and other cities who they need to help figure out the diplomacy and how the diplomacy might work. It could be, I mean, that's sort of the optimistic side. It could also be that they will make common cause with warlords who were on the other side of the longstanding Afghan civil war that followed the withdrawal of Soviet troops before the Taliban won that war, the so-called Northern Alliance that included a bunch of pretty vicious and pretty brutal, not just warlords alone, but their militias, which then fought on the side of the U.S. and remain connected to the Afghan government. Some of those, the most notorious warlords, are emerging right now, talking with people in the former government as they haven't all faded away. Some of them have remained in Afghanistan. There are reports that Ashraf Ghani, the president of Afghanistan, was not able to land his plane in either of the two countries he tried to go to and ended up coming back to Afghanistan, that he may be in Kandahar. I haven't heard confirmation. The BBC was reporting that yesterday. But I think that the Taliban is in a position, particularly given a long history in Afghanistan, where wars and disagreements tend to be resolved by negotiations more often than fighting. The fighting is often reserved for the outsiders. The notion of Afghanistan as the graveyard of empires has a basis in history, but it's also true that it's not unusual in Afghan history to see things like we saw in the last several days, where it wasn't so much the Taliban being so strong that they could overcome this massive U.S.-backed, U.S.-armed military force of 300,000 soldiers, but that rather that military force, which was never 300,000 soldiers, a lot of them were so-called ghost soldiers, but that when the Taliban showed up, the soldiers on the other side said, you know what, these are the guys that are going to win. I want to be on the winning side. I'll come over to your side for now. And maybe later something will be different, but for now, I'm not going to fight. There's that history of negotiation as a part of Afghan culture. So it's not so far-fetched to imagine that there will be people that Afghans of the Taliban, because it is an indigenous Afghan organization, despite longstanding support from Pakistan, would reflect that and would engage with others to be part of a government. We should be clear, I think, that the Taliban will be the dominant force. They will call the shots at the highest levels, but it may well be that they determine it's in their interest to include some other individuals or some other social forces to give them a broader level of credibility within the Afghan population itself.
Speaking of Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, her books include Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. Phyllis, I have intentionally stayed out of U.S. politics for the first half of our interview. It is obviously the only thing consuming most of our media in this country, and it is incredibly narcissistic. But I did want to ask you, you know, as someone who was against the war before it started, who has wanted it to end for the 20 years it's been happening, when you see the chaotic images of the collapse of the Afghan government, people dying in the evacuation from the Kabul airport, do you look at it and think the U.S. could have ended the war or should have ended the war differently?
I think that is the right question, Brian. Yes, I think they could have done it better. I think the answer to what does better look like is not move it back, don't do it now, wait for a better time, because there is no easy time. This was not only predictable, it was predicted that whenever a president finally had the political will to carry out what, among other things, 70% of the United States population wants, aside from what Afghans might want, that it was going to be a terribly hard and probably brutal process that was going to be really, really hard on Afghans. There's no question about that. Were specific mistakes made here? Absolutely. Some of those mistakes, the most important ones, were rooted in the mistakes from the very beginning, as you said, before this war began. Right after 9/11, when the decision was made to respond to that horrific crime with going to war, part of that already was looking at, and we are going to recreate Afghanistan in our image. We're going to impose a government that looks like a Western parliamentary democracy. And if anybody had the temerity to say, excuse me, you know, the people of Afghanistan have sort of their own thousands of years of history about what kind of governments they have, and they never involve centralized power in the capital. Never. Why do we think that's going to work this time? Well, what a surprise, it didn't work. Even putting aside the level of corruption and incompetence of the individuals who were kind of inserted to become that government, the notion of a nationally centered government with power based in the capital, far away from where the vast majority of Afghans live, was never going to work. So why would we have expected that a military that was built up to support that government would somehow be willing to fight for it? The lower ranks of that military, they didn't even support this government. They weren't being asked, as President Biden said in his speech last night. It was the important part of his speech was that he recommitted to his decision to withdraw. That was, I think, the most important part. But in the rest of his speech, he said some terrible things. His accusations of the Afghans somehow being cowards, that they did not want to fight for their country. They were never given the chance to fight for their country as they wanted it. They were being told to fight for a government they never supported.
Phyllis Bennis, what do you think this does to the kind of foreign policy establishment in Washington, D.C., inside an orbiting government that has always found a reason for the U.S. to stay in Afghanistan a little bit longer?
I think that in the short term, we're going to hear all kinds of accusations and...
Sonali. They worked together from when Sonali was... Before she was a journalist, she was started the Afghan Women's Mission. Now it's Afghan Women's Fund. That's what she was referring to there. It's time for me to go. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And turn you over to a couple hours with a breaking labor story, which sounds...
It sees all and it knows all and all it wants to do is use you.
Oh!
understand that it's got to work this way. Understand that God knows, God knows.
This extraordinary consistency of an anti-war mobilization, which at the beginning was tiny and isolated, and it was hard to be against the war in those days. Barbara Lee, the heroic congresswoman from your area, who was the only member of Congress, the only one in the House, there were none in the Senate, not one, who were prepared to stand up and vote no on the authorization for the use of force, knowing that it was going to lead to unimaginable circumstances in the future. Only one member of Congress. The reason that that would not happen now, that there would be a couple dozen, is because we have fought as a movement in the streets to elect progressives. All of those things are different now. Now, has it changed all the policy? Of course it hasn't yet. We still have a lot of work to do.
What do you think the U.S. owes Afghanistan? No?
We owe an enormous debt to the people of Afghanistan. We owe reparations for the damage to their country, not only in the last 20 years, but from the role the U.S. played in the war against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. The creation of what were then known as the Mujahideen, including, of course, infamously, Osama bin Laden. You know, the U.S., through its Saudi funders and its Pakistani fixers, were the ones who created these organizations and empowered these extremist forces to be the most likely force that could beat out the pro-Soviet forces in this proxy war of the Cold War era that was being waged in Afghanistan throughout the 1980s. We owe compensation. We owe reparations. We owe real rebuilding. We don't owe continued occupation. That's clear. But I think that one of the challenges that we face is that the amounts of money that we're talking about when we talk about the need to rebuild a society along the lines that Afghans want, not rebuild a society that never existed in the image of the United States systems. How that would work, we don't even know yet. Who should get that money? The corrupt government that was in power until 2 days ago? No. The government that's going to be led by the Taliban? That's pretty unlikely. Where would that money go? The non-governmental organizations that have sprung up in Afghanistan over the last 20 years, some of them are doing incredibly important work. But the notion that any of them have the capacity to absorb those huge amounts of money right away, I don't know what that would look like. It may be that it has to be an organization like the United Nations, or perhaps regional multilateral organizations with all of the problems that brings in terms of lack of sufficient representation of Afghans themselves. This is a really hard challenge, but we owe... When we look at what the U.S. has spent, $2 trillion over these 20 years of you know, $1 trillion to build just the military side. If we used a tenth of that amount of money to help Afghans rebuild their country as they wish it to be, I think that's a start. I think that we have issues right now that are very crucial. I think the demands we have to be focusing on right now all have to do with our obligations to the people of Afghanistan. That has to start with a vast expansion of access for refugees and asylum seekers to come to the United States, expanding the categories, making it easier, making it possible for a much wider range of people to apply for that, for those who want to leave their country. That's obviously not everybody else. We need to be demanding that an end to the bombing raids that were going on at least until 2 days ago, that stop is permanent, that the CIA death squads are permanently dismantled. We need to make sure that our government is supporting whatever UN and international efforts are underway for creating a humanitarian corridor and guarantees of safe passage for humanitarian workers, because right now the humanitarian crisis is the most urgent thing. And that means also funding a massive COVID assistance program for Afghanistan, particularly for the internally displaced people that are so desperately in need. And finally, I think we need to take this moment when people are still stunned by the visible failure of this 20 years of failure of U.S. policy in Afghanistan. We need to take this moment to push for at least the beginnings of acknowledgement of U.S. responsibility for what this war has done to the people of Afghanistan, including recognizing U.S. war crimes. That means stopping our opposition to the investigation being carried out by the International Criminal Court. It means acknowledging, at least before we even get to the question of apology, but acknowledging that the United States and its forces, its political forces and its military forces, are responsible for the war's devastating impact on the people of Afghanistan.
I want to thank you so much. I expect we will have you back again sometime soon. Phyllis Bennis is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her books include Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan.
And the host was Brian Edwards Tiekert, who does a great morning show a couple hours with a woman named Kat Brooks on KPFA on Monday. They have a very excellent virologist on. I listen to it pretty regularly to get the latest COVID information. He's a great interviewer. And there's some great calls and messages from the audience in the Berserkly area. All right, we're going to now go on with something from South California. Sonali Kalatkar is a producer there. And I always thought she was well, when I first came upon her, I thought she was Afghani, but she's actually Indian, South Asian Indian. And but she was involved in forming a group called the Afghan Women's Mission, which I think she's interviewing a colleague that works on what's come out of that. Sonali, they worked together from when Sonali was, before she was a journalist, she was started the Afghan Women's Mission. So now it's Afghan Women's Fund. That's what she was referring to there. It's time for me to go. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And turn you over to a couple hours with a breaking labor story, which sounds...
God sees all and it knows all and all it wants to do is choose you.
Afghan president, the elected president in the administration out of Afghanistan and brought the Taliban to the present palace. Everybody was surprised, including the Taliban, and even outsiders, the Western media, the Western countries were surprised that they advanced so fast. But the situation was such that they kind of actually prepared that. They prepared that situation for them for the past 2 years, giving them legitimacy, giving them position and prestige and even money and so, and then undermined the Afghan government and undermined the people of Afghanistan and the interest and will of Afghan people. So that is the betrayal that the Afghan people can never forget or forgive, and I cannot. As an Afghan American, as a women's rights activist, this betrayal just really appalled me, and it's just pained me very, very much.
The former Trump administration officials like former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have blamed President Biden for what they're saying is a botched withdrawal. The liberal media has been laying it at his feet as well, saying that this is Biden's Saigon moment. But as you suggested, it's been a couple of years that the United States has been directly holding peace talks with the Taliban. And actually, it even goes beyond that, right? Didn't peace talks with the Taliban in secret start under Obama? They chose to work with the Taliban and very explicitly excluded the Afghan government that the United States itself had propped.
Well, from outside of the United States, we see every administration the same. We don't differentiate from people from outside. They know that it doesn't matter if there's a D in front of them or R in front of them. The foreign policy does not change very much. Whatever Trump did, Mr. Biden, he implied it. That was the deal. And Mr. Biden did not change his position. Did not actually take the responsibility to the Afghan people or to the Afghan government, to the world, or to the democracy and the human rights and women's rights that they are giving slogan all the time. They did not even respect that. They did not show any loyalty to those slogans either. So it doesn't matter who is in power. The foreign policy does not change very much. Mr. Pompeo can attack Mr. Blinken. Mr. Blinken can attack him. But as far as we know, as far as the Afghan people know, we were betrayed by every administrations, by Trump and by Biden administrations.
Let's talk about the Afghan politicians. President Ashraf Ghani fled the country over the weekend. There are some reports saying that he left with, helicopters full of cash. He's being excoriated for abandoning his country. And then the former president, Hamid Karzai, who was initially installed by the U.S. government as an interim president, but then won elections, he has chosen to stay in the country. He recorded a video of himself with his three young daughters and is now overseeing a coordinating committee with former vice presidents of Afghanistan, or current actually vice presidents of Afghanistan, to have a smooth transition of power. So what do you make of Ashraf Ghani's decision to leave the country? If Hamid Karzai can stay, why couldn't Ghani?
Well, he couldn't. He was not able to stay because they forced him out of prison palace. Some aides say that they came there and
Meaning the Taliban?
The Taliban and the Americans. They forced him out, they put him in a helicopter and they forced him out. Another report or rumor say that the Taliban were going to hang him on the 19th, just like they did with Dr. Najibullah. He was forced out of out of the palace. The lies that they are spreading that he took money and this and that. First of all, Ghani, anything that you can say about Ghani, he was not a thief and he was not somebody who had the love of money in his heart. He wanted to help. He wanted to work for Afghans. He probably had many, many faults, but that was not one of the negative point that he had. So these things are lies and Ghani does not need the money. He worked for World Bank and he was a professor, and so is his wife. He's 72 or 73 years old and his children are well educated, and so they don't need it. And he lived a very simple lifestyle. Those who stayed in Afghanistan, Mr. Karzai and others, yes, the U.S. brought them there, and although there were like a Tom and Jerry fight between them, but he wanted to serve the Taliban, and whatever criticism he did of the Americans, it was because he just wanted to form friendship with the Taliban. Karzai was always on the side of the Taliban. Actually, if you read the book of Mr. Gates, he said that Karzai wanted the Taliban and the Daesh to in north to be in control, and they spread them out and gave them a lot of power there. So that was what he wanted. And the others who are staying there, like Abdullah, they are the warlords. When the U.S. first invaded Afghanistan in 2001, the U.S. brought these warlords to power. They gave them money, they gave them power, they gave them positions, and they gave them a lot of leverages. So these people who were nothing or nobody, just the warlords, and overnight they became millionaires. And of course, they formed their own militias, and they had a lot of power. They were always sabotaging the Ghani government. From the first time in 2014 when Ghani won, in the 2019.
Sonali, they worked together from when Sonali was, before she was a journalist, she was started the Afghan Women's Mission. It's Afghan Women's Fund. That's what she was referring to there. It's time for me to go. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And turn you over to a couple hours with a breaking labor story, which sounds...
It sees all and it knows all it wants to do is choose you.
What happened. The vice president of Afghanistan, Mr. Saleh, he is somewhere in Afghanistan, although they forced Ghani to leave. What it is here is that this so-called champion of democracy in human rights, who the United States called themselves, they talk themselves about people who believe in inequality and believe in election and believe in this and that, and then they attack other countries and sanction other countries who do not have elections or human rights. They attack them, but they, the United States, betrayed the people of Afghanistan and acted exactly the opposite of what they are saying, against human rights, against women's rights, against election, against the elected government of Afghanistan, the deals, the backdoor deal in backstabbing of a country. The country that sacrificed so much for the United States in the past 40 plus years, now it's sacrificed again because of the U.S. foreign policy, failed U.S. foreign policy and U.S. interests in the region.
So let's talk about what's happening to ordinary Afghans. Scenes coming out of Kabul at Hamid Karzai International Airport on Sunday were really shocking. People running on the runways as an airplane was trying to lift off. Some people hanging on to the plane. This is a U.S. Air Force airplane trying to lift off. And you know, overnight, thousands of people at the airport trying to flee the capital as they know what is in store for them, as they fear what is in store for them under the Taliban. What are you hearing about the fear, not just in the capital, Kabul, where we're getting a lot of information from, but even elsewhere in the country, some of the rural parts of Afghanistan?
The rural, as you know, we have a lot of projects in the rural piece, in the rural of Afghanistan, rural part of Afghanistan, and I'm in contact with some people. The stories that they are telling me from underground, the stories that they are calling and begging to please help. There are people who are on the street. Our volunteers are on the street. They cannot go back to their home, raping and attacking and leaving their homes and no food, no shelter. It is appalling. It is inhumane. And if this cannot, if that those pictures, those images of the airplane flying and people are hanging, if that cannot awaken the conscience of these politicians who betrayed the people of Afghanistan, I do not know what will awaken their conscience. And if that does not do it, if that does not awaken and shaken their humanity, I really am, I'm losing all my faith in humanity. I'm losing all my faith in American government. They better shut up and not call about talk about human rights or women's rights or humanity or democracy anymore.
Fahima, you and I have been working and worked together for many years to try to change the U.S. government's policy toward Afghanistan. And you remember, I'm sure, clearly more than most of us, how the U.S. used Afghan women's rights to justify the occupation. And then for almost 20 years, we were told Afghan women are free because the U.S. is there. And look at all the awful things that will happen to Afghan women if the Taliban leaves, and now the Taliban is leaving. And we're hearing more justifications for those who wanted the war to continue, not necessarily for the U.S. occupation to actually do something constructive, but they just wanted the U.S. troops to remain there. They're once more invoking Afghan women as if they cared about them all along. What are your thoughts on that, on how women, Afghan women's freedom has been used as a justification for war and continues to be used as justification for a war that has not brought them freedom?
So now you heard me many, many, many times that I said that those who U.S. put back in power, first of all, those that U.S. supported 40 years ago, they were the violators of human rights and women's rights. And then U.S. put those people in power, and then 92, and then 96, the Taliban, who the second generation of those terrorists. And then after that, again, in 2001, when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, they put the very people who were against peace, against stability, and against women's rights and human rights, U.S. put them back in power. It seems like U.S. Put them in trash, and then they take the trash out and recycle them and use them on us and force them on us. And then they put them back in the trash and then use them on us. But in the process, what the U.S. does hurts the ordinary people of Afghanistan, bomb the ordinary people of Afghanistan, use them and bomb them and put their puppet, their proxies, their terrorists force them on us. And then when something goes wrong, they don't like it, they just replace one set of terrorists with another set of terrorists. That's what the U.S. does, recycle, and that's what we are going through this cycle for the past 40 plus years. And of course, the women of Afghanistan are angry. Of course, they are upset because the women of Afghanistan were used. Mr. Bush actually in Congress said the women of Afghanistan are free. 20 years later, you go and put them back in prison. Although they were not free, in the last 20 years, they were not free, they were being used. But after 20 years, you put the same people back in power to imprison those women. Where is the humanity?
What should Biden have done? I mean, of course, he didn't, you know, he's been in the presidency for less than a year. But there are many who point out that the withdrawal was done without any thought. In fact, when Bagram Air Base was abandoned by the Americans, they did it with so little coordination with the Afghan army that Taliban forces, we read, came and looted that air base, took weapons and ammunition, and the Afghan National Army didn't even know that the Americans had left in the dead of night. I mean, that's just one sort of symbol of the speed and lack of coordination and organization with which the U.S. left. Could just that have been done better? It seems as though every chance the U.S. has to do something in Afghanistan, it chooses the wrong way to do it.
And they do it on purpose. You know, when you say Biden government, I don't care who is in power. I'm just calling it the U.S. government, the U.S. administrations, anybody who is there. So, yeah, they left at 3 a.m. without notifying the Afghan government, without notifying anybody, like cowards. They left in, like thieves. They left and left everything to the Taliban. And at 3 a.m. when the Afghan army, somebody woke up and said that the American military is not there. You know, how can you do that to a country? And again, I'm always against the invasion and was against the invasion, and I'm not for military solution. But once they went there, getting in all these years, they empowered the terrorists, they empowered the Taliban, they empowered the Mujahideen, and they empowered the Daesh. They're different names, different attires, but the same school of thought. that they came from the same school of thought. They empowered them so much that with the so irresponsible withdrawal of their troops gave them even more power and gave them legitimacy. That's why they took over. You know, the right way should have been to be responsible to find a solution and help and work with the Afghan government to control everything, to not sabotage the government and then leave. But they did all of that, of sabotaged and left and irresponsible and empowered those terrorists. So of course, I mean, the country is in the hand of terrorists from outside, from inside, and also from Pakistan. Pakistan has the biggest terrorist camps there. They, you know, if US was really serious about it, which it was not, of course, we all knew all along, serious about war on terror, they should have closed the sanctuary. They should have closed the training camps the terrorist training camp in Pakistan. But they did not do that, and they were in cahoot with Pakistan government. And whatever the Pakistan government told them, you know, they did that just because they did not want to lose Pakistan completely to China. And so it is just because of their politics, their interest. 35 million people were sacrificed. You know, I just read today, somebody wrote, it's dangerous to be America's enemy, but it is deadly to be American's ally. Mm. That is something that you know, people have been posting. That's what people have been saying. And really, to be allies with Americans, our hearts are broken for a broken nation.
This is such a difficult time, Fahima. I'm sure you, like many other Afghans, have been approached by Americans saying, what can we do? How can we help? But it feels like that question should have been asked for the past 20 years, right? I mean, Afghanistan was just forgotten. Even when the war first started, more people paid attention to Iraq. And then it's just been this afterthought for so long. And now it's, you know, fallen apart already. It's already in the hands of the Taliban. And the questions of what can we do to help? There are no good answers, right? I mean, it's too late.
The answer would have been 20 years ago to help with the education and healthcare and security and peace in Afghanistan. You know, I should say that, Mr. Ali, the people of United States are generous people. They want to help. Of course, most of them don't know what is going on in their name in other countries. But, you know, we got some help here and there from people to just build a school and dig a well or open some literacy classes and this here and there. And we have done that. And people still want to do that. But the solution is not just to bring, you know, a few thousand people here. There are 35 million people there. What will happen? You can bring a few educated people here and they will go and wash dishes and work in a restaurant or drive a taxi. But what happens to the 35 million people there? What happened to the 15, 16 million women there in that country? So what happened to the 5 million girls who are going to school? What happened to them? And to, like I said, to the rest of the country, what happened to them that you put all these 35 million people on a silver plate and gave them, delivered them to a terrorist group that you went after and bombed the hell out of that country for 20 plus years. Yes, the financial help will help immediately with shelter and food and this and that. You know, a few thousand people here, a few thousand people there. But we need big help.
To give our audience a link or a website for where they can support the work that you do, Fahima, with the Afghan Women's Fund.
We have a small volunteer organization that we gave 100% of the support back to Afghanistan. It's Afghan Women's Fund. It's www.afghanwomensfund.org. Anybody who wants to help, they can donate money. And if they want to volunteer their times, or if there are many, many of our volunteers who are underground, they are crying for help. Their lives are in danger. Their families' lives are in danger. They are crying for help. They want to get out of there because they don't think that they would live any longer there. They're in danger. So if anybody can help them temporarily to just bring them out of Afghanistan or somewhere, which that is not the solution for Afghanistan, but at least you know, a few people here and there, they would be safe. So go to Afghan Women's Fund website and just support us any way you can. All your support will go back to the people of Afghanistan. Thank you.
Sonali Kalhatar with her friend Fatima Jihaz, something like that. You can find Rising Up with Sonali. They worked together from when Sonali was, before she was a journalist, she was started the Afghan Women's Mission. It's Afghan Women's Fund. That's what she was referring to there. It's time for me to go. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And turn you over to a couple hours with a breaking labor story, which sounds...